Stand, please.
Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court. Be seated, please. Case number 10-55433, Stephen LaRoque et al. Appellants versus Eric H. Holder, Jr., Attorney General of the United States et al. Mr. Maupin for appellants, Ms. Tomey for appellees.
All right, counsel, thank you for accommodating us as we switch the cases around.
No problem.
May it please the court. Under the nonpartisan elections referendum enacted by the voters of Kinston, plaintiff John Nix could get on the ballot in the upcoming city council election simply by filing a notice of candidacy and paying a filing fee. But Section 5 is suspending the implementation of that referendum and thereby preserving the old partisan elections regime, under which Nix cannot get on the ballot unless he spends additional money and time by either gathering signatures from voters or winning a party primary. Consequently, Section 5 is injuring Nix, and that injury will be redressed by a judicial order facially invalidating Section 5, which will eliminate the only barrier to Kinston's mandatory state law duty to implement the referendum.
Why isn't your remedy to go to the city council and have them bring an action under Section 5? Have you just lost politically?
No, Your Honor. The reason is because Section 5 is the barrier that we are challenging. All Kinston can do is to try to get out from underneath the statutory barrier by seeking preclearance. But our position is that the statute itself is unconstitutional, and the obligation to seek preclearance is itself the unconstitutional action. It is Congress that acted unconstitutionally, and all Kinston can do is seek to remove that injury under the statutory scheme. That does not prevent us from seeking to eliminate the constitutional injury by challenging the statute on its face in the first instance.
Let me ask you, did you want to say something else?
No.
All right. I want to ask you about prudential standing, and in particular about the Tennessee Supreme Court's decision in Tennessee and
Tennessee Electric,
in which case I'm talking about.
I do, Your Honor.
Yeah. How can you make your prudential standing argument in view of Tennessee? I understand your argument about New York v. USA. I understand that. But given that Tennessee is still good law, what do we do with that?
Well, Your Honor, I think Tennessee is actually based on the legal rights framework that has long been discarded by both the Supreme Court and this court. And so I would submit, as both the petitioners and the Solicitor General in Bond argued in the Supreme Court, that the holding in Tennessee Electric does not apply.
Well, the Third Circuit ruled that it acknowledged, you know, New York, and it acknowledged the change in theories about the Tenth Amendment. But as it said, Tennessee Electric has never been overruled by the Supreme Court.
Well,
and it pretty clearly says that, as long as this sentence is there, my question is, what do we do about it? It pretty clearly says, absent the states, appellants have no standing to raise any question of the Tenth Amendment.
Your Honor, I would submit that since Tennessee Electric is based on the protected legal interest test that has been discarded by the Supreme Court subsequently.
Discarded where?
In, I believe, the ASCAP, the Associated Data Processing case, and
did it overrule Tennessee?
It didn't overrule Tennessee. It overruled the legal test that Tennessee was applying when it said that the plaintiffs.
Well, you can argue that, and you've made a very strong argument about that. But our obligation is to follow Supreme Court decisions until the Supreme Court overrules them. Quote, I'm reading to you from Hahn, Supreme Court decisions remain binding precedent until the court sees fit to reconsider them. regardless of whether subsequent decisions have raised doubts about their continued viability.
I think there's a difference between raising doubts about the continuing viability and actually overruling the legal test that was applied in the earlier case, and that is what has happened here. The protected legal interest test has been discarded by the Supreme Court unequivocally.
Do you know of a circuit court decision that's done that?
Under the Tennessee?
No, under any. I know about the Seventh Circuit. It disagrees with the Third Circuit, and it thought it was free to ignore Tennessee, but... Do you know of any, what case would you cite for us doing that? I guess that's my question. What case would you cite, if we were going to write a sentence in the opinion that says, we as a lower federal court need not follow Tennessee because its underlying theory has been changed by subsequent Supreme Court decisions, what case would I cite for that?
Off the top of my head, Your Honor, yeah. I can't think of a case.
I can't either.
But I do think it would make...
Now, one thing is we might wait to see what the Supreme Court does in Bond.
That is one possibility. I would suggest that would be an unwise decision in this context, given, as this Court recognized when it expedited this appeal, time is of the essence here. And
so you don't think we should wait for Bond?
I don't think you need to wait for Bond, because as even the Solicitor General recognized in Bond, Tennessee Electric does not bar and should not bar.
Well, but you and the Solicitor General are free to take that position, and you may well be right. But my question is, are we free to do it? That's the question.
I submit that you are, Your Honor, uh-huh. because in a case where the Supreme Court has actually overruled the legal test applied in an earlier case, you would be acting inconsistent with the subsequent Supreme Court case, which says...
And it's New York that you rely on for that proposition?
Not just New York.
What else?
It's the series of cases that overruled the protected legal interest test. Mm-hmm. It's the ASCAP, it's Associated Data Processors versus CAMP, I believe, is the canonical case. This court has recognized that in, I believe, the Parker decision from 2007, that the protected legal interest test is no longer good law, that the test for determining standing is injury in fact and causation and redressability.
But I was asking about prudential stuff.
I understand, yeah. Your Honor, but I think the key to understanding the Tennessee Electric decision is to understand that it was applying the protected legal interest test. I don't think it says explicitly that it was applying a quote-unquote prudential standing doctrine.
But that's true.
And I think the rationale...
It's only one sentence. I mean, it's even a fragment of a sentence.
It is. It's a fragment of a sentence, and it's a fragment of a sentence applying a doctrine that has since been explicitly and unambiguously repudiated uh-huh. by both the Supreme Court and this Court. And so I think it would be inconsistent with those subsequent cases mm-hmm. to follow that scrap of a sentence, particularly in the situation where the Solicitor General has agreed with us. And if you are in any doubt, you could wait for Bond. I do submit, though, that given that this Court recognized the times of the essence, that would be unwise in this particular context.
Did you want to say something more about that issue?
No.
Okay. So I only have one more question here. This is, notwithstanding the wording of your complaint, this is a facial challenge, right?
This is a facial challenge.
Yeah. So given that, I'm curious about your standing to bring count two. As I understand it, your core argument here is that, I have two questions about this. One is that, quite apart from the two new amendments that were added to the Voting Rights Act, Section 5 would have its postponing effect without regard to those, right?
Well,
in other words, if this is just a facial challenge, your injury flows from the operation of Section 5 without regard to the amendments.
So first of all, of course, Your Honor, and I think Your Honor's question recognized this, our first claim would wipe out Section 5 on its face in all circumstances. So,
correct.
So with respect to just our equal protection claim, our position is that there are only two. The preclearance standard applies. There's a effects prong and a purpose prong. And both the effects prong and the purpose prong have been rendered facially unconstitutional
Correct.
Based on this, on the amendment. So our submission.
Based on the amendment?
Based on the amendment.
I thought they were unconstitutional because I thought the problem flowed from the fact that Section 5, which we have to assume is unconstitutional, right, blocks the effectiveness of the referendum.
Our submission on the equal protection claim is that the statute imposes a block on all state law changes, and that block can only be lifted if you pass through both of the preclearance prongs. And our submission is both of the preclearance prongs are facially unconstitutional.
If we strike down the Section 5 without regard and pay no attention to the two amendments, if we just strike down Section 5, where's your injury? What's left?
I'm sorry, if you strike down Section 5, that would redress our
injury. Section 5 is unconstitutional.
That would redress our injury because then there's no longer a federal barrier.
That's my point. So where does your standing come from to challenge the two new amendments? That's my point.
Well, our argument is that the two new amendments are one of the reasons why Section 5 is facially unconstitutional.
I'll try once more. Do you agree that we could strike down Section 5 without looking at the two new amendments?
Yes.
Okay. And since you've brought a facial challenge, doesn't that end the case?
I don't think it does, Your Honor. There are alternative claims. Our first claim is that, wholly apart from the Equal Protection Clause...
My point is, suppose you win that.
Well, then we've won the case, but yeah. You never...
Where does the standing come from? There's no injury there's no injury inflicted by the amendments. Right?
If we win our first claim, yes, it's true, but... If we don't win our first game, then there is injury from the amendments.
No, but without regard to whether you win it or not, the harm you're claiming, that is, the harm, am I right? The harm you're claiming is the fact that Section 5 postpones the effectiveness of the referendum, correct?
That's correct, and okay. We think there are two reasons why that is unconstitutional.
I understand the first reason. What's
right.
The second one?
The first is that you understand the first. The
yeah,
second
right.
Is that it is suspending it in order to make it, in order to satisfy a racial preference scheme.
Okay,
both the effect.
This, I see. But in this case, and this is my second point, in this case, the objection in this case didn't implicate either of those amendments, did it?
That is not correct, Your Honor.
No?
The objection letter squarely applied the ability to elect prong. That is all it applied. It did exactly what the Supreme Court in Ashcroft said should not be done under the pre-amendment standard, mm-hmm. where all it did, the sole and exclusive factor analyzed, was whether the change impacted the ability to elect. There was no other circumstances considered, nothing like feasibility considered. The only factor considered was ability to elect, and that is the precise problem.
Let me try my first question once more. Would your basic claim about the unconstitutionality of Section 5 be any different pre-amendment than it is today?
Our first claim would not. Our second claim obviously would. Our first claim is that Congress couldn't impose Section 5 at all.
At all. That is the postponing, the blocking effect of Section 5, right?
That's correct.
And that argument's the same pre and post
right. If we win that claim, we're done. The reason we're bringing a second claim is we might lose that claim.
No, I'm not asking the question about whether you win it or not. I'm asking why, I still don't understand why those amendments injure you given the theory of your case.
The theory of our case
is... It's the blocking effect of Section 5 occurs with or without the amendments.
The reason it injures us is because it subjects us to the block in order to... The only way to get out from the block is to satisfy a racial preference. And if the block itself was not unconstitutional under our first claim, it is at least unconstitutional because we have to satisfy a racial preference to get out from under the block. Of course, if imposing the block in the first instance was unconstitutional, we win under claim one and that's the end of the case. But if we don't win on our first claim, which is why we have a second claim, if we have the second claim, the reason we have it is because imposing a block to serve a racial preference scheme is itself facially unconstitutional.
What does the world look like if you win on your first claim? If Section 5 is unconstitutional on its face, what does that do to all the preclearance decisions that were made?
With respect to any change made after 2006, those changes can go into effect because they've...
Okay, only after 2006?
Well, our position is that it's only after 2006 because it is only those changes that have never been subjected to a valid federal preemption. Anything that was before 2006 was validly preempted under a federal law that the Supreme Court has held was a valid enforcement of the Reconstruction Amendments. So we are only challenging the 2006 reauthorization, and our arguments would only apply to changes that postdated 2006. If I could reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Linda Tomey. I represent the Attorney General in this appeal. I'd like to first address the prudential standing question raised by Judge Tatel. In our view, New York or Tennessee has not been overruled. It does support our argument in this case, but it's not necessary to rely on Tennessee to reach the result that we advocate. Yes. Worth v. Selden makes it clear that under the prudential standing rules, plaintiffs cannot assert the rights of another party. And that principle is all that's necessary.
But under New York, they're not.
Pardon me?
I said under New York, they're not. They interpret New York as vesting a right to raise a 10th Amendment issue in an individual.
But in New York, the plaintiff was a state, so New York does not hold.
No, but the 10th Amendment, New York says quite clearly that the 10th Amendment protects states not because they're states, but in order to protect individuals.
Well, we're not relying on the 10th Amendment. We're relying on the prudential standing principle set forth in Worth, which is that
No, my point is I only said that because you said they were seeking to protect the rights of the third person, namely the state, right?
Well, but
and New
but
York seems to suggest that that's exactly what the 10th Amendment was designed for.
Well, I don't think New York supports the plaintiff's argument because there's no holding in New York that anyone other than a state could assert the rights.
No, it wasn't a standing case.
And in the language that plaintiffs rely on in New York was in response to an argument that because state officials had supported the legislation at issue in that case, the state was therefore stopped from challenging its constitutionality.
Even in Bond, the plaintiff in Bond, or the defendant, I guess it's a defendant, right? In Bond is challenging the rights of a third party, namely the state.
That's correct, but Bond and many of the other cases cited by the plaintiffs are different than this case because plaintiffs always have standing, and this was the position of the United States in Bond, and the reason we cited that case or our argument in that case is that plaintiffs always have standing if they are directly regulated by the statute or the agency that they're challenging. In Bond, the person challenging the constitutionality of the statute was a criminal defendant.
Well, that's what gives her Article III standing, her injury. And Nix, let's just assume for a minute, Nix has his Article III standing from the injuries he claims, namely the disadvantage of having to run in a nonpartisan election. That's where they both get their Article III standing. But they're both, it seems to me, isn't it true that they're both Bond and Nix are attempting to assert or vindicate the rights of the state?
Aren't Not they? In the same way.
Why?
Defendants who are directly regulated by a statute always have standing to challenge it. That's the case in Bond, it's the case in United States versus Lopez, mm-hmm. Morrison versus United States, where the plaintiff or the person challenging it was a defendant in a civil case. In this instance, the plaintiff is not regulated by the statute that they're seeking to challenge in any way. They're indirectly affected by it. And in our view, that's the whole point of prudential standing. The fact that you may be injured by that you may have Article III injury as a result of the application of a given statute does not give you necessarily mean that you can challenge it if you're asserting
you're not taking account of New York.
Of
the Supreme Court's decision in New York.
Well, I think that language in New York was going to a different point. It did not in any way hold.
Isn't the larger point of the federalism, the whole federalism doctrine, is it's not to protect states as states, it's to protect individuals, right?
It's to protect individual
whatever
rights.
Harm is caused upon the state here flows through to the individual. I thought that was sort of the bedrock principle of federalism that informs New York and the other.
But it's to protect the rights of individuals through the state by permitting the state to regulate in areas that the federal government should not, or precluding the federal government from regulating in areas in which should be reserved to the states. The plaintiff's complaint in this case, in their count where they make their federalism claim, their claim that Congress lacked the authority to enact, refers to burdens on jurisdictions and denial of local self-governance. They simply don't have prudential standing to assert those rights of the jurisdiction, particularly in this instance, unlike Lopez or other criminal statutes, where the jurisdiction has its own remedy here. In a criminal statute like Bond, or the statute in Bond, or the statute in United States versus Lopez, there's no way for the state to come in and vindicate its interest in preserving its
just right. Because the state, or in this case the city, has a remedy doesn't mean that that the plaintiff here doesn't also have a remedy. I don't know of any case that would suggest that. I mean, if the plaintiff has standing, Article III and prudential standing, then they have standing, even though someone else may have. In fact, one of the points that New York makes about this is that there are situations where the political entity, namely the city here, which clearly would have standing, might have very good political reasons for not wanting to bring the case, and that's exactly what New York. That's one of the reasons why New York says that that these rights are rights. These protect the rights of individuals, not just the state. And that's exactly the kind of case we have here, because you know, I mean, there may be very good political reasons in this case why the town and this town chose not to, for the same reasons that the Attorney General objected to the change. The town probably had pretty good political reasons for not challenging it.
And if you assume that plaintiffs have standing here, they do have a cause of action. And their cause of action is against the jurisdiction.
That won't solve their injury. If they have, at least I don't think it will. As I understand their complaint is about an antecedent problem. They're not complaining about the city's refusal to challenge the, correct me if you think I'm wrong about this, they're not challenging the city's refusal to challenge the Attorney General's objection. They're not even challenging the Attorney General's objection. They're arguing that Section 5 causes them injury by blocking the effectiveness of the nonpartisan referendum. That's their injury, and suing the city won't solve that problem.
Well, that's their claim, but it's not their injury.
It's not?
Their injury stems from the partisan election system. All of their injuries stem, well, Section 5 might be allegedly the antecedent cause of their injury. The injury itself stems from the partisan election system. And they have ways in which they can challenge the partisan election system. They could, for example, bring they apparently have a state law claim.
No, you're missing my point. Do you agree with me that their core complaint here, and we have to assume for purposes of this that Section 5 is unconstitutional, right? Okay.
Right.
So their core complaint is that an unconstitutional federal statute blocks the effectiveness of the referendum, right? That's their core complaint, isn't it?
Correct.
Okay. So I don't see how they have any remedy to challenge that other than this essentially pre-enforcement action they brought.
Well, the Supreme Court and this court and the three-judge court in D.C. has never recognized an action by private plaintiffs against the Attorney General in connection with Section 5.
That's because all of those actions, I think that's because it's pretty clear that you can't challenge an objection. You just bring a new action in a three-judge district court, but they're not challenging the objection. You agree with me?
Well, but there are other instances. For example, in the Shaw cases, mm-hmm. Shaw v. Reno and Miller versus the Miller case, the Supreme Court affirmed the dismissal of the United States, of the Attorney General as a defendant in those cases. The plaintiff's complaint was that the, and the plaintiffs were allowed to go forward with their complaints against the jurisdiction, challenging the constitutionality of what they claimed was actually injuring them, which was the underlying election system that they contended was unconstitutional. In this instance,
that's not what they're claiming here.
Well, they're claiming that Section 5 is unconstitutional, but they can assert.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead. What?
They can assert that claim in other ways rather than suing the Attorney General.
Yeah, but that's my whole point. Is that you, just because there may be, two answers to that. I think one is just because there may be an alternative remedy doesn't mean they don't have this remedy. And besides, I don't see. Maybe I should ask the question instead of making the statement. Explain to me how, in a suit against the city, the plaintiffs here could litigate their argument that Section 5 unconstitutionally blocks their right, state right, to a nonpartisan election.
They could.
Where would they make that argument?
They apparently have a state cause of action against the city for the city's refusal to implement the referendum. That's their legal claim, is that they have a right under state law to have the referendum implemented.
And would they file that in state court?
They could file that in state court.
And what would the state court do? Declare Section 5 unconstitutional?
Well, presumably the city would interpose Section 5 as a defense. The case could be removed to federal court. But in that instance,
But how would that solve, I see.
It would be a different case than this because the
right.
city would be
that's a party. Not the case they brought. This is we have to decide whether they have standing to bring the case they brought.
Well, standing is a different question than whether they have a cause of action. We've argued they don't have standing at all, in which case you don't even reach the cause.
By the way,
of action.
Does the government agree that if we were to declare Section 5 unconstitutional, that the referendum would then go into effect?
It's likely that we don't rely on the redressability argument.
Right. So you agree with that. I have another question. You one of the arguments that you make that I thought was that intrigued me was you say at one point that the plaintiff's injuries were sort of self-inflicted, right? Caused by his own decision to run.
Correct.
And so, how would he avoid? And we rely on McConnell for this, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So now McConnell, the plaintiffs could avoid the injury simply by taking advantage of the higher funding limits, right? The higher contribution limits.
Correct.
So how does that work here?
Well, I think the McConnell is the plaintiff's injuries here, their alleged injuries that the their opponents will be able to raise more money and get support from parties, and they will not be, Nicks will not be allowed, able to do that if he runs as a nonpartisan candidate, is akin to the injury in McConnell. It was a matter of choice. Mr. Nicks can choose to run as a partisan candidate. He's chosen
not to.
He
could choose to run as a Democrat?
Well, I suppose he could choose to run as a Democrat if he wanted to become a Democrat.
You don't think there would be, I guess he could also choose not to run, right?
Correct.
Okay, but you don't think there'd be some serious constitutional problems in us saying that he doesn't have standing because he has the power to give up his right to run in a nonpartisan election or to give up his right not to run at all? You don't think that would create serious constitutional problems itself?
Well, I think this is, he has no legal right. He has no right to run in a nonpartisan election.
But for Section 5, he has a state right to run in a nonpartisan election, doesn't he?
Well, but that's exactly why we think that this case should be framed
Don't go back to the other question.
Okay.
Aren't I right about that? But for Section 5, he has a state right to run in a nonpartisan election.
That's correct.
And so you're suggesting that we hold that he lacks standing because he could always give up his state right to run in a non. I mean, I'd suspect that government would. You didn't make that argument in your. You didn't take the next step. You didn't say what I'm asking you to say here in your brief. And I suspect I know why. And that is because I think it would be a serious constitutional problem to suggest that a plaintiff lacks standing because the plaintiff can always avoid can avoid the harm by giving up a constitutional right.
Well, I think it's not so much that he can avoid just that he can avoid the harm, but that the harm is not legally cognizable because it's a harm that is not legally protected.
And why isn't it legally protected?
Well, it's the difference between McConnell and Shays. In Shays, the plaintiffs alleged that the candidates that they were opponents would be allowed to raise money in ways and engage in tactics that were not permitted by the campaign finance statute, that were unlawful. Mm-hmm. And this court specifically distinguished McConnell from Shays on that ground. Mm-hmm. There's nothing that unlawful about a partisan election scheme. It's been upheld by the Supreme Court.
No, that's not their point is that they have... They're not claiming there's anything unlawful about the partisan campaign, the partisan election system.
Correct.
Right? I don't think they're arguing that.
Right.
I think they're arguing they have a state right now that the referendum passed to a nonpartisan election, a right that's blocked by an unconstitutional federal statute. That's totally different from Shays or McConnell.
Well, I think the difference is also that they're not even alleging that. I think the fact that they're not alleging that it's unlawful is a difference between Shays and this case.
I want to turn your attention, if I could, to your argument that if there is standing, there's no cause of action.
Correct.
I'm talking about count one.
Okay. Right? I'm sorry.
What were you going to say?
Well, as to count one, I think our argument is that the court has simply not recognized any cause of action in relation to Section 5 for private plaintiffs, and they have an alternative. The court has suggested in Shaw and in Morris versus Grissett, where plaintiffs have an alternative way to bring their remedy, they should not be challenging suing the Attorney General.
So let's pursue that for a minute. Do you think... that for purposes of for the cause of action issue under count one, that's the only thing I'm talking about now. Do you understand plaintiffs are challenging the objection?
They certainly began this case to challenge the objection. They have dropped that challenge.
Yeah, they're not challenging that. They're only
not
arguing
it now.
Right. So there's no. So you agree with that. So then, if you agree with that, if you agree that we don't, in order to resolve this case on the merits, we don't have to review the Attorney General's objection.
Correct.
Okay. Then I don't understand then I don't understand why this isn't just kind of a classic pre-enforcement challenge, which we entertain all the time. That's why the Attorney General is a defendant, because they're seeking a declaration that the law is unconstitutional and injunction to prevent the Attorney General from enforcing the act.
But in allowing that case to go forward, this court would be recognizing a cause of action that has not been recognized in any Section 5 case before.
Yeah, but is there any case that says they don't have a cause of action in this situation?
Well, I think there are cases that clearly direct them towards another kind.
Is there a case that you can cite that holds that there is no cause of action in a situation like this where there's no challenge to the objection?
Well, I don't think anybody's tried to bring specifically this kind of challenge.
That's exactly my point.
But
so therefore, it's not particularly responsive to my question for you to tell me that no other courts sustained a cause of action in a situation like this when you just conceded there's never been one like this.
That's right, but I think
setting that aside, tell me, just reason it out for me. Tell me why there isn't a cause of action here, given your agreement that they're not challenging the objection, this is a kind of a classic pre-enforcement challenge. Tell me why there's no cause of action.
Well, it's not a pre-enforcement challenge in that the plaintiffs would not have standing if Section 5 had not been enforced in this case. So it's not exactly like a pre-enforcement challenge. In that sense, it's to some extent an as-applied challenge.
Okay, forget
it. It wouldn't arise
if I said about pre-enforcement, because you didn't raise it, they didn't raise it. I apologize for raising it. But just tell me why there is, setting aside your point that no other courts allowed this, which I think we just agreed is because no one's brought a case like this, tell me why in a situation like this where they're not challenging the objection, they're challenging the constitutionality of Section 5 because it blocks their state right to a nonpartisan referendum. Why, and assuming I disagree with you about standing, why they don't have a cause of action? I don't understand that.
They don't have a cause of action because they have other ways than suing the Attorney General that would more directly address their injury, which stems from the application of Section 5 in this case. And that would be to bring...
If I wasn't persuaded by that argument, then is there anything else?
Just that I think it's one can reason from Morris versus Grissette and Shaw v. Reno and Miller v. Johnson that the court has clearly directed these kinds of challenges away from challenges to the Attorney General and to challenges to the underlying voting practice, which is what their real complaint is about here. Their complaint is that they're injured by the voting practice.
No, that's not the way they drafted their complaint. Their complaint is that they're injured by the fact that Section 5 blocked the referendum. What they claim is their injury.
That's what their claim comes from, but the injury would not occur but for the nature, the way the voting practice affects NICS as a candidate.
Well, that's what gives them their standing. I mean, assuming they have standing.
Assuming they have standing.
They're, right? I mean, we're talking about two different things.
Right.
Their claim is that it's blocked. Their standing, their injury flows from the fact that, according to them, the partisan system is less beneficial to them, costs them more money to run in, and it's harder for them to win. That's where their injury comes from. Maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong, but that's different from the question I'm asking you about whether they have a cause of action to bring this particular claim.
Well, I think the reason is because their cause of action and their injury is so closely related to the partisan election system that the case would be better litigated in a forum in which that was a part of the cause of action. In other words, they should be bringing a case against the city challenging the retention of the partisan election system. In the course of that, they could also raise their constitutional claim.
Maybe they should, but they for some reason chose not to bring that case.
They've chosen not to bring the case because their real interest is in striking down Section 5, but what their real injury is in this case stems from the partisan election system, and that's why, in our view, that should be...
But see, they wouldn't be injured. They wouldn't be injured but for Section 5, the nonpartisan... In other words, their injury could not have occurred. If you're right that their injury stems from the nonpartisan, having to run in a nonpartisan election, right?
Right.
That they would never have suffered that injury had Section 5 not blocked it from going into effect, right?
That's correct, but they also would not be injured but for the partisan election system, assuming they're injured at all. And so there's the two things.
They took care of the partisan election system with the referendum. That they were injured by the partisan election system. They got the people to vote it out, but it was blocked because of Section 5. So why?
It is, but that's why their state law right, if they have one, stems from the referendum and from state law. And in our view, if they have a cause of action, it would be in state law, in state court, in connection with it would begin in state court. I think we all understand it would be removed to federal court. But it would be a different cause of action here because it would implicate whatever state law rights they might have. It would also implicate their interests in a nonpartisan election, and then it could also implicate the constitutionality of Section 5. And that is the proper way that this controversy should be raised.
I want to be sure, I know I'm taking you over your time, but I want to be completely sure I understand the government's position on prudential standing. Did you say to me that you didn't think Tennessee is what blocked this case? Tennessee Electric.
It has not been overruled. It certainly supports our position, but we don't think it's necessary to our position.
Okay.
Worth v. Selden supports our position.
Worth v. Selden. That's
yes.
Your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So,
what do you think about that last point?
Oh, yeah.
I was exactly what I was about to start with, Your Honor. If you set aside Tennessee Electric for a second, the government's principal position on prudential standing is that, well, it's worth, but more generally the proposition is that private parties who are benefited by state law don't have standing if the federal government preempts that state law. Under that rationale, Congress could, for example, ban all subsidies to Planned Parenthood, and Planned Parenthood would have no standing if the state chose not to appeal. The federal government could ban all state environmental laws, and people who benefit from environmental laws wouldn't have standing to appeal if the state chose not to appeal. There are myriad state laws that benefit private parties, and private parties have standing to challenge the federal government's unconstitutional preemption of the state law, whether or not states appeal. We've cited several examples in our briefs of cases where private parties did benefit from state law. The state chose not to appeal the federal court's invalidation of that law, and the private parties were held to have standing. So I think that setting aside Tennessee Electric, neither Worth nor any other case supports the proposition that private parties don't have standing if a beneficial state law is preempted by the federal government. And it's for exactly the reason Judge Griffith suggested. The limitations on the federal government exist not to protect the states qua states. They exist to protect individuals. And that's particularly true here when you're dealing with a voter-enacted initiative. This is a law that was passed by the people for the people. And the city officials are actually the ones who benefit from the prior regime because they were elected under the prior regime. It makes no sense to say that the only people who can defend that law are the states, not the private people who actually benefit from that law. We are not asserting the state's rights. We are asserting our right to individual freedom from Congress acting beyond its enumerated powers. So that's what I would say on prudential standing, setting aside our prior discussion about Tennessee Electric. Turning to the cause of action issue, the district court's primary holding was that we didn't have cause of action because we needed to seek review of the attorney general's objection. The government has now conceded we are not seeking review of the attorney general's objection and that we don't need to. That, I think, is the end of this case because while she says that we haven't pointed to a cause of action or a case saying we have a cause of action, there's a centuries-old cause of action to challenge federal statutes that are unconstitutional and that cause injury to private parties. It's their obligation to show why we can't invoke that cause of action. The district court's only argument why we couldn't is we needed to seek review of the attorney general, and they've now conceded we're not seeking review of the attorney general. And then the final point I would like to make is that they continue to...
I thought the district court's point was a little different, is that Section 5, I mean, it's this whole question the government's arguing about the difference between your injury and your cause of action. And that's what the district court was focusing on.
So the district court was focused on that, but the problem with that argument is that our injury comes from the fact that Section 5 was applied to us, but we don't need to challenge the Attorney General's application to say that the statute shouldn't have existed in the first place. Clinton versus New York and the line item veto case and the legislative veto case show this.
I thought your injury came from the fact that Section 5 blocked the implementation of a referendum which would have advantaged. In other words,
That's exactly right. Our injury...
It's not just the blocking. You wouldn't have any injury you wouldn't have standing if the effects of the referendum were neutral, right?
That's correct. Our injury comes from the fact that a beneficial state law has been preempted.
Right. Okay.
And it has not been removed under this federal statute.
So the government says, well, you have better, what you should have done, I think what they're saying is you should have filed a state law, an action in state court, right? Remove it to federal court, right?
So there are several problems with this. First of all, there's the threshold point that Your Honor noted that there's no requirement under either standing doctrine or cause of action doctrine that if you have one potential lawsuit, you can't file a second potential lawsuit. But let's even set that aside for a second. I don't know what state cause of action they're talking about. Mm-hmm. We have repeatedly said that the city of Kinston has a state law duty to implement the referendum. But I not all clear to me that we could actually file suit in state court under some state cause of action to require them to comply with that duty. Maybe there's a mandamus action available. I don't know. I fairly doubt that you would be able to bring a mandamus action against a state official for following federal law, presumptively constitutional federal law. So I don't actually know what cause of action they're talking about. It certainly couldn't be removed, by the way, because the federal constitutional question would come in as a defense. And it seems quite clear that Congress wouldn't want the constitutionality of Section 5 to be adjudicated in that sort of manner, where a state court was determining whether Section 5 was constitutional on its face. In fact, we know this quite clearly because in Section 42, 1973L, Congress has said that challenges to Section 5's constitutionality should be brought in the District Court of the District of Columbia, which is what we did.
Let me just go back one question, just to be sure I understand your position about Tennessee Electric, okay? So you want us to do what the Seventh Circuit did, basically, not the Third Circuit, right?
I have to be honest, I can't recall exactly what the Seventh Circuit said, but what I would say is...
The circuits are completely split on this question about whether Tennessee Electric remains a binding precedent. And the majority of circuits have said it is. And this court has said, in an earlier case, we don't really have to decide that question.
Right. Yeah, if the Seventh Circuit has said that Tennessee Electric is no longer a binding precedent because the legal interest test has been repudiated by the Supreme Court in subsequent binding holdings that this court has likewise applied, mm-hmm. then yes, I think you should follow that course. Mm-hmm. It's one thing to say that the reasoning of a subsequent case undermines the reasoning of a prior case. That is the sort of canonical Agostini and Scherzing, the Agostini line of cases where you say that the circuit court can't overturn a past precedent of the Supreme Court based on subsequent changes in reasoning. But when the actual rationale of decision has been overruled by the Supreme Court in a subsequent case, I think this court has to follow the subsequent Supreme Court holding.
But when you and I were talking about this with your opening argument, you couldn't cite a case that says that.
I could not think of a case off the top of my head, but I do think, Your Honor, that you would be violating the second Supreme Court precedent. The second Supreme Court precedent said the legal interest test is not valid law. So if you apply a precedent applying the legal interest test...
We're going in circles here, but as I read the Supreme Court cases, they basically say to we who serve on the, quote, inferior courts, you follow our precedents until we expressly overrule them. That's the way we've operated that way here.
Critical distinction is whether the second Supreme Court case undermines the reasoning.
Yeah, that's a really good argument, but I'm not sure we're free to go that way.
Well, let me put it this way, Your Honor. I don't see how you would be complying with the second Supreme Court precedent.
Well, the Supreme Court can always fix it by reversing us.
Well, that's true, whichever way you rule.
That's what they're there for.
That's true, Your Honor, but they could do that either way. And my point is simply, when you have a second Supreme Court precedent that is itself binding, you should follow that. There are no further questions.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.